This study on biblical covenantalism is offered for the edification of all students of God's Word by spiritandtruth.org. Dr. Paul Hennebury, president of Telos Biblical Institute, will be our teacher. It's our prayer that this presentation will deepen your understanding of the Bible and allow you to draw closer in your relationship with God through His Son, Jesus Christ. Now let's hear from Dr. Hennebury as he continues his presentation on this important topic.
Continuing to look at why the New Testament cannot be seen as reinterpreting the Old Testament, which is what perhaps the majority of evangelical scholars and pastors teach, I want to begin by giving a quotation from Graham Goldsworthy and his book, According to Plan. We've read from this before, and it's an influential book. Goldsworthy is a very influential Reformed biblical theologian. And Goldsworthy, on page 66 of his book, has this to say, quote, "We must conclude that a method of interpretation that demands that the promises of the Old Testament be literally fulfilled so that there is exact correspondence between what is promised and what eventually comes to pass does not fit the evidence of the Bible. Of course, there are many details of fulfillment in the New Testament that exactly correspond to the promise. Such literal correspondence of a few details does not establish a principle of literal interpretation." Goldsworthy says, quote, "In our first two models of revelation, the Old Testament takes priority over the New and interprets it. The gospel event is simply the occurrence in history of something that was long since revealed to the full. But according to the New Testament, Jesus is the word that explains all other words. He comes to achieve what was promised in the Old Testament, and, in doing so, he shows that the promises were but shadows of the fulfillment. It is, therefore, not at all self-evident how any given promise will be fulfilled." I'm going to repeat that. "It is, therefore, not at all evident how any given promise will be fulfilled." Now, what that means is that when God promises very clearly in places like Jeremiah 31 and Jeremiah 33 that Israel will continue as a nation and will inherit her covenant blessings as stipulated in those covenants, that we are not to take that as self-evident. So what I've said about the fallout from believing that the New Testament has interpretive priority over the Old Testament is not far-fetched. Remember, we've already said that believing that the New Testament reinterprets the Old Testament means that the Old Testament's authority to speak with its own voice is devalued. And it also creates two levels of inspiration. The New Testament is really more the Word of God than the Old Testament is. Goldsworthy continues, "We should not be surprised at this, for in the incarnation, God accommodated his truth to a form that human beings could comprehend. Likewise, the nature of revelation as elemental promises, which are progressively built upon by further revelation, was an accommodation to the condition of mankind." End quote. This is a common ploy by supersessionists. What they do is that they claim progressive revelation, but actually what they're doing is not progressive revelation, because it's not progressive. You see, a progressive revelation would be like you see in the prophecies in the Old Testament which speak about Messiah. Those messianic prophecies build up a picture of Messiah so that by the time Messiah comes, you've got all of these prophecies about where he will be born, from which tribe, in which city, how he will die, and so on and so forth. You've got all of them to which Jesus can point to about himself. That's progressive revelation. But that's not what Goldsworthy is teaching. Goldsworthy is teaching that the revelation given in the Old Testament is typological, as we'll see in a moment. That is to say, it is not apparent and would not be apparent to the original hearers what God's intent was or how these words were to be fulfilled in the future. You could not take them literally. Goldsworthy argues strongly against what he calls literalism, so one had to wait for a further interpretation, which would be, of course, supplied by the New Testament. And we've seen the problems with doing that, not the smallest of which is that the New Testament wasn't part of the Bible of the early church. So what you have in covenant theology is not really progressive revelation at all. It is altered revelation. In other words, to quote Goldsworthy again, just so we understand, it is therefore not at all self-evident how any given promise will be fulfilled. If it's not evident how the Old Testament texts are going to be fulfilled because the New Testament transforms them, makes them into something else, or point in a direction that nobody would have thought of, then clearly we don't have a progression anymore, we have an alteration. And so it's important that you understand that those that believe that the New Testament interprets the Old Testament have a funny view of progressive revelation. It's rather strange, this, the way that they use terms, and we're going to get to this in a minute. But there's a slippery use of terms and terminology that's involved. And you have to really nail them on it, because otherwise they kind of convince themselves that that's what they're doing, when that's not what they're doing. They're using the wrong descriptors to define their process. Now, on the next page, page 67 of his book, According to Plan, Goldsworthy writes, quote, "Literalism involves the very serious error of not listening to what the New Testament says about fulfillment." Really? I think we have listened to what the New Testament's been saying about fulfillment, and about other things too, and we've been listening pretty carefully. I think the problem is, and we'll bring this out, that really it's not what the New Testament says which is the issue. It's what the commentators and theologians claim the New Testament must mean. And it's that interpretation that is being read back into the Old Testament. It's not what the New Testament says that is often the issue. There are some issues that are raised by what the New Testament says. We've looked at some and we'll look at others. But most of the time, what you're going to come across is that it is their interpretation of the New Testament, which is theologically controlled, which is being read back into the Old Testament. Finally, he says towards the bottom of page 67, "If we rule out both literalism and allegory, is there any other way of expressing the relationship of the Old Testament to the New? Indeed, there is. Progressive revelation establishes the principle of typology." End quote. There you see. It's typology. Everything's a type in the Old Testament. Now the question comes up, if everything in the Old Testament is a type, or many of the important doctrines in the Old Testament are types, then how are they to be interpreted? They can only be interpreted when their antitype shows up. And their antitype shows up in the New Testament. Ah, but now we have a real problem, don't we? Because the New Testament, you see, wasn't around when Jesus was teaching. The books of the New Testament didn't start to be written until about the first 20 or so years after Jesus ascended. And we might put Matthew to the early 40s. I have no problem with that. I think that's very probable. But there's a problem there, because Matthew is the gospel which shows most continuity with the Old Testament, doesn't it? And separates Jews and Gentiles very clearly. So there's an issue here, you see. Typology. Would the original authors have understood that they were writing in types? It doesn't appear so. And again, we're going to show how that is the case. One other thing I should note here, in the first quotation that I gave from page 66, Goldsworthy starts off by talking about the first two models of revelation wherein the Old Testament takes priority over the New and interprets it. Well, can you see that he's set up a false dichotomy here? He has set up two models where the Old Testament has interpretive priority over the New. And then he brings in his model, the second model, if you like, because the first two can be collapsed down into one, wherein the New Testament reinterprets the Old. Well, folks, we're not teaching either of those options. We're just teaching that neither testament needs to reinterpret either of them. Neither testament should be given interpretive priority over the other testament. And there's a very simple reason for that. Because they don't contradict. Because there is a unity between them. But that unity has to be understood by taking the words at face value. The church is a new thing. It's not in the Old Testament, as Paul tells us. Therefore, we shouldn't expect to find the church in the Old Testament. We shouldn't expect to find any mention of the new covenant being made with the church in the Old Testament. We shouldn't expect any real hint about the church as the body of Christ in the Old Testament, because it's new. It's a New Testament truth. But because the church is a New Testament truth, doesn't mean that we throw out all of the Old Testament truth. We just have to incorporate this added truth, this progressive revelation, onto the picture we've already got. And that's what we're trying to do in these courses in biblical covenantalism. All right, let's get to the next reason in these 40 reasons for not reinterpreting the Old Testament with the New. We're not going through all 40, but we are going through quite a few of them. Look at number 29. A God who would expand his promises in such an unanticipated way, remember what Goldsworthy said, could never be trusted not to transform his promises to us in the gospel. Folks, what's good for the goose is good for the gander. If you have a God who operates and speaks in an ambiguous way in the Old Testament so that you can't anticipate what he's going to do from his words, surely can't you see that we can't anticipate what he's going to do in his gospel promises either? As it goes on to say, thus there might be a difference between the gospel message as we preach it, relying on the face value language of John 3:16, John 5:24, Romans 3:23 through 26, for example, and God's real intentions when he eventually fulfills the promises in the Gospels. I hope you can see that. Since it is thought that he did so in the past, it is conceivable that he might do so again in the future and expand his promises in an unanticipated way. Perhaps the promises to the church will be fulfilled in totally unexpected ways with a people other than the church just being a shadow of a future reality. After all, according to this view, Israel thought that their promises were to them as a nation, but it turned out not to be so. So how do we know in the church that the promises given to the church are actually going to be fulfilled by the church? We don't, you see, because we are saying, if we hold to this view, that that's not how God has operated in the past. This is a very slippery view. Next, exegetically, it would entail taking passages in both testaments literally and non-literally at the same time. And I give some examples that we'll look at. Now, when I say literally, I just mean it in the sense that everybody means it when they're not talking about prophecy. I had an online debate with a reform guy called Steve Hayes a short time ago when I quoted to him, numerous guys, G.K. Beale, Graham Goldsworthy, G.B. Caird, John Frame, Vern Poitras, and others who used the term literally or face value when they were talking about things other than prophecy. For example, G.K. Beale in his A New Testament Biblical Theology, page 155, says, quote, "The notion of the coming final judgment is picked up again in 2 Peter and Jude. At the time of this judgment, the earth and its works will be burned up," 2 Peter 3:10. "This is likely a literal expectation on the part of the author." What does he mean by literal? He just takes it for granted that we understand what he means by literal. Now, when I pointed these references out to Hayes, he just ignored them. He simply ignored them. And this has been very typical of my interactions with these brethren. They tend just to ignore what they don't like and not to engage the specific questions that they're asked. Ask another question in its place. Let's look at this example of employing two different hermeneutics in the same verse. Look at Isaiah chapter 9 and verses 6 and 7. "For unto us a child is born, unto us a son is given, and the government will be upon his shoulder, and his name will be called Wonderful Counselor, Mighty God, Everlasting Father, Prince of Peace." Now our brethren want to basically interpret that literally. Yes, they do believe that Jesus has the government upon his shoulder now. I don't believe that, but it is based on a literal interpretation. I hope you understand that. They do believe he's actually governing now. You say, well, do you believe it's the government is actually on his shoulder? Well, of course not, but that is figurative, isn't it? Literal interpretation, properly understood, which is grammatical historical interpretation, by the way, literal is not a technical term at all, employs figures of speech. When a person's been working hard at a physical job all day and comes in and says, "I'm shattered," they're obviously not saying that they're bits and pieces of them all over the place. No, but they do expect you to take them literally, which is they are tired, because the term shattered can mean tired in one of its uses. And here, the shoulder is being used figuratively for bearing the government. The government is upon him. That is, the responsibility for government is upon him. And that is within the realms of literal interpretation. That is understood. His name will be called Wonderful Counselor, Mighty God, Everlasting Father, Prince of Peace. Some of that might be difficult, but all of those names and titles could be given to Jesus. Yes, even Father. Not as God the Father, but as an Everlasting Father to the nation. Certainly. Verse 7. "Of the increase of his government and peace, there will be no end." They would believe that. "Upon the throne of David, and over his kingdom, to order it and establish it with judgment and justice from that time forward, even forever, the zeal of the Lord of hosts will perform this." This is where things get slippery. You see, a straightforward interpretation would interpret the throne of David there, not as the same literal chair, of course, that David sat on, but as a throne of the kingdom line of David set in Israel, his kingdom, an earthly throne of David, which is certainly what was meant in its context. Somebody who holds to, say, covenant theology will say the throne of David is actually the throne of God in heaven, which is a very odd interpretation, because certainly the throne of David in the Old Testament is not the throne of God, and nobody could come to that interpretation by reading the Old Testament. And remember, the throne of David in Luke chapter 1 is also not the throne of God. It's the throne of David, which Jesus will sit on. So, in order to make the throne of David the throne of God, they have to spiritualize it. I hope you see that. They cannot take it literally as the actual throne of the Davidic kingdom. Therefore, the kingdom, in that verse, is also spiritualized and turned into heaven, or turned into the whole earth in the new creation, none of which it talks about. Let's have a look at another example. The famous prophecy in Micah 5:2. "But you, Bethlehem Ephrathah, though you are little among the thousands of Judah, yet out of you shall come forth to me the one to be ruler in Israel, whose goings forth have been from of old, from everlasting. And in the context, you'll see that he is a shepherd over his flock, verse 4, and that he rules over the remnant, verse 3. See also the remnant in verse 7 and verse 8, and how they are differentiated from the Gentiles in verse 8. So in Micah 5:2, and also in the quotation of it by the scribes and Pharisees in Matthew 2, verse 6, the interpretation is that Messiah, who is, remember, King of the Jews, Matthew 2:2, will sit on a throne over Israel. And there is nothing in this context in Micah 5, or indeed in Matthew 2, that contradicts that. But we have evangelical brothers and sisters who will insist that even though we are to believe, literally, that Messiah was to be born in Bethlehem Ephratah, that he wasn't to be ruler in Israel, in the way the second half of the verse clearly says, but that he was to rule over a spiritual Israel, the church, in heaven, which is certainly not what Micah or Micah's interpreters in Matthew 2 understood by that language. So how did they turn Israel into the church, being ruled over by Christ in heaven? Well, by employing a different set of hermeneutics, a hermeneutics that comes about when their interpretation of the New Testament is read back into the Old Testament. We'll try one more in Revelation 7. In Revelation 7, verse 4, we're told, I heard the number of those who were sealed. 144,000 of all the tribes of the children of Israel were sealed. And then you have the list of the tribes. All of them are real tribes from Israel, and 12,000 coming from each of the tribes, which equals 144,000. Now, I would interpret that literally. This means what it says. But an amillennialist will come along and say, no, this 144,000 is symbolic, and Israel is symbolic, and each of the tribes is symbolic, and the number 12,000 is symbolic. And then they'll read verse 9, after these things, I looked, and behold, a great multitude which no one could number, of all nations, tribes, peoples, and tongues, standing before the throne and before the Lamb. And they will say, that's literal. So you have verses 4 through 8, which are symbolic. Then you have verses 9 and 10, which are literal. And the Israel of verses 4 through 8 are, in fact, the all nations of verses 9 through 10. Even though the 144,000 are on earth, and the ones standing before God in verses 9 and 10 are in heaven. But this is how this continues, you see, when you start down this path of saying that the New Testament reinterprets the Old Testament. The New Testament does interpret the Old Testament in certain ways, but when it does so in a way that is compliant with what the Old Testament text actually says. Now, sometimes there are applications of Old Testament truths to the church or to individual Christians. One would expect that. We do that all the time. But the actual covenanted promises will still be fulfilled in exactly the way they've been promised. And the New Testament does not lead us to think that will not be the case. In Reasons 33 and 34, I refer to Acts 1:6, and in 34, I say, this resistance to the clear expectation of the disciples also ignores the question of the disciples, which was about the timing of the restoration of the kingdom to Israel, not its nature. And that should be clear from just reading the question. But you see, what often happens is that we get a subtle shift in our millennialists and postmillennialists, and they start to concentrate on the nature of the kingdom of Israel instead of the timing of the restoration, which is what was asked about. Jesus' response in Acts 1:7 was a refusal to give the timing of the restoration. It wasn't to speak about the nature of the kingdom. Neither was verse 8. Why would they do that? Well, they would do that because they're not interpreting the New Testament at face value, you see. If they were, they would see that in the New Testament passage in Acts 1. But you see, they're not doing that. They're reinterpreting the passage on the basis of an already decided upon theology, And that is what's being read into the passages. Because of the effect of reading certain theology derived from the New Testament back into the Old Testament, it affects books in the New Testament too, particularly the book of Revelation, which is made into symbolical nonsense that only scholars can penetrate. Therefore, reason 35, I say, it turns the admonition to keep the words of the prophecy in Revelation 1:3 into an absurdity, because the straightforward, non-symbolic understanding of the numbers, 7, 42, 144,000, 1,000, etc., persons, tribes of Israel, two witnesses, beast and false prophet, and places, Jerusalem, Babylon, New Jerusalem, which is in large part built upon the plain sense of the Old Testament, is rejected in favor of tentative, symbolic, typological interpretations. You see, if you take the book of Revelation at face value, it dovetails very nicely into the Old Testament. But you see, if you're saying that the Old Testament is typological and can't be taken, for the most part, at face value, then you have to do something with the book of Revelation. And you have to say, well, that can't be taken at face value either. You see, otherwise, if you didn't do that, you would have a full book in the New Testament that disproved your view that the New Testament is needed to reinterpret the Old, instead of just, in the progress of Revelation, reveal more of what is already in the Old. Further, behind this view that the New Testament is needed to interpret the Old Testament is this assumption of the one people of God. But the Bible doesn't have to teach anything but what it teaches. I hope that we all understand this. God can do whatever he wants, whether we understand it or not. Our job is to read what God says and try to make sense of it. It is not to tell God what he can and cannot mean by what he says. Now, the fact of the matter is that the Old Testament speaks about Israel and the nations, for example, in Zechariah 14:16 and following. Paul speaks of Israel and the church as separate, distinctive groups. Romans 11:25 and 28, Galatians 6:16, 1 Corinthians 10:32. And the book of Revelation speaks of Israel separated from the nations in Revelation 7, and those in New Jerusalem distinguished from the kings of the earth in Revelation 21:9 through 22:5. And that's in the eternal state. Therefore, it is very precarious to place every saved person from all ages into the church, the one people of God. If you do that, you're ignoring these clearly taught truths in the scriptures, both in the Old Testament and the New Testament. And we'll have more to say about that. Number 39. This view, which espouses a God who prevaricates, and that would be the right word, in the promises and covenants he makes, also tempts its adherents to adopt equivocation themselves when they are asked to expound Old Testament covenantal language in its original context. If you have not seen this with our covenantal brothers, then I advise you to take them to Genesis 15 or Genesis 17 or Jeremiah 33, verses 14 through to the end, and ask them to expound it to you. And you will see that they will not deal with the details of the text. It's like they have an aversion to it. Another good place would be Zechariah 14. You will see that they will want to deal in generalities. They will not want to get down into serious exegesis of the text. They're going to read their theology into the text. And then when you say, well, hold on, you're reading your interpretation of the New Testament into the Old Testament. Therefore, you're denying authorial intention of the Old Testament writers. You're not doing grammatical historical exegesis, in other words. And then they will start saying, well, are you saying this? Or what about this? In other words, they will start in with sophistry instead of dealing with exegesis. We don't have to deal with any sophistry until a person has dealt with the text. You don't do that with cultists who come to your door. You say, let's look at the text. Never mind the questions. Let's look at the text and what the text says. Then we can address the questions. We can't address questions until we know what God says. Otherwise, we don't know that our questions are the right questions. So I continue here. It often tempts them to avoid specific Old Testament passages whose particulars are hard to interpret in light of their supposed fulfillment in the New Testament. What is more, it makes one overly sensitive to words like literal and replacement and supersessionist and that, even though these words are used freely when not discussing matters germane to the subject. And then finally, number 40, I point out the fact that because they are used to reading in their theology into the New Testament and then reading that into the Old Testament, they are blind to their presuppositions. So that when you point that out to them, that that's not what the text says, that's what you're inferring from the text, you will find that they will play at puddle jumping with you, and they will start jumping from one inference to another inference, or one question to another question, instead of actually dealing with the text you're trying to get them to deal with. So I say, of course, the Old Testament is not allowed a voice on par with what the New Testament text is assumed to make it mean. Only verses which preserve the desired theological picture are allowed to mean what they say, and that's the key. They will preserve literal interpretation or plain sense, grammatical, historical hermeneutics when they're dealing with, say, the gospel of justification, or the resurrection of the dead, or eternal security, or something like that, the deity of Christ, and so on. Those major fundamental doctrines, they will use plain sense interpretation with. They must do, otherwise they can't get to those doctrines. But when it comes to eschatology, when it comes to the covenants, when it comes to the plan of God, well, that's all been worked out, you see, on the basis of something else. In covenant theology, on the basis of the theological covenants and the one people of God principle. In new covenant theology, which is a new kid on the block, it's done again on the basis of the one people of God. Even though they reject the theological covenants of covenant theology, they still believe very strongly in the priority of the New Testament over the Old Testament. So I continue, hence a vicious circle is created of the New Testament reinterpreting the Old. It's actually what's happening is that the New Testament is not being interpreted correctly either, because that's being interpreted via theological presuppositions. This is a hermeneutical circle which ought not to be presupposed, because it results in two-thirds of the Bible being effectively quieted until the New Testament has reinterpreted what it supposedly really meant. Well, we can't deal with God's revelation that way, folks. Or at least we shouldn't. And what we're trying to do in these courses is to show you that we don't need to do it either. Israel always means Israel. The covenant promises have to be kept the way God has obligated himself to keep them. And they will be kept and they will be fulfilled through the new covenant in Jesus Christ. And this brings us to our next issue, which is the recent ploy of replacement theologians has been to deny that they are actually teaching replacement theology, even though they actually are, and that they're saying that Jesus is the new Israel. And as the church is in Jesus, then the church can be said to be the new Israel as well. And so that's what we're going to examine in the next couple of lectures. We have to deal with this new phenomenon or new question of, is Jesus the new Israel? And that's what we'll be going on to next.